In session with Bertram, I am aware that I experience him more like a colleague than like a patient. I feel as if I were suddenly in the body of a smaller, weaker man. This is troubling, and yet also oddly exciting. I can feel the hidden goings-on, like tiny, poisonous fish scudding beneath the surface, shiny but deadly. Throughout my evaluation, Bertram is given the impression of answering my questions. But once the session is over, I realize I understand little more about his condition. He is always slipping from my grasp. Early on, I notice another peculiarity. Bertram's eyes seem to shift slightly in color with his changing mood. We walk back to my office in silence. He sits in his usual chair across from my desk and begins speaking as if we had been in the middle of a conversation. "It's why I'm here," he says. "Why I came into the hospital." "I'm not sure I follow you," I say carefully. His eyes are impatient. "It's pretty obvious. Could you give me a little more to go on?" I'd have thought it was clear that I'm not really a psychiatric patient, that I've come here for reasons other than mental illness. I've had many patients maintain they were as sane as I. Only recently, an elderly woman insisted I was the one who should be locked up, not she. She claims to be your very own Queen Victoria, and has taken to imitating my English accent with uncanny accuracy. She intends to try me for treason, for abandoning Mother England. "I needed to find a place where there was little chance of being found," Bertram continues. "Who is it you need to avoid?" "My brother," Bertram says, looking a little surprised. During the intake interview, Bertram had struggled to explain why he'd voluntarily committed himself. What he finally said was, "The world seems strange. Nature, the light, people, sounds, food. I feel stranded, as if everything's becoming unmoored from itself." He talked of a kind of elastic dread that made him jumpy and exhausted. But there was no mention of a brother. "I don't recall you mentioning a brother before today." Bertram turns sideways in his chair. "I had my reasons for keeping quiet on the subject." "What has changed?" I ask. "You may think it a misuse of the hospital system, but the truth is I fear for my life. I didn't know what else to do." His grey eyes seem suddenly touched with green. I sense his fear. "Go on," I say. "I don't know where to begin." "Just begin anywhere." Bertram looks out of the window. "We had a neighbor," he says. "Rosamond. We both loved her, though I loved her more. When I was 12 and Rosamond was 11, she and I decided that one day we would be married. It wasn't a child's game. We were serious." "What is your brother's name?" I ask. "Emmanuel." There was always something disturbing about him. Bertram pauses, seems to be searching for words. As if he didn't live in the same world as everybody else, but had learned to act as if he did. He falls silent. "You were talking about Rosamond," I prompt. "Rosamond was killed in an accident." Bertram's voice catches on the words. "After Rosamond died, Emmanuel started to seem crazy. I'd been afraid of him before, but now I felt like my brother might actually become dangerous. He blamed me for her death. I know he did. It wasn't rational. He also blamed me for the fact that she'd liked me more than she'd liked him." "When did you last see Emmanuel?" "I haven't seen him since the divorce." "The divorce?" I don't know what he's referring to. "Soon after Rosamond died, my mother left my father. She took me with her. Emmanuel stayed with my father." "And you've had no contact with them all these years? With your father and your brother?" Bertram shakes his head. "We moved. We began a new life." "How is this connected with your being in the hospital?" "I needed to feel safe. I couldn't think..."